Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. This winter has brought a lot of snow and snowy owls.
Oh, those eyes.
Yeah.
Those eyes are beautiful.
Some southern West Virginia residents almost always have unusable water.
We usually have to do bottled water because we don't drink it at all. Even on good days, we don't ever drink the water here.
We visit an old general store with a new purpose.
Kids used to come from up to school and buy their lunch. They buy cookies and cokes.
And learn more about the world of crayfish research.
This is called the bottle brush crayfish. It's native to the Green River in Kentucky.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. It's been a big year for snowy owls. People have reported seeing thousands of the magnificent Arctic birds from Erie, Pennsylvania to Washington, D.C., all the way to the island of Bermuda. Researcher says there are more owls this season than anyone has reported in 50 years. They call a population boom like this an eruption. The question for many is, why is this happening? The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
They started showing up last fall. Most years, birdwatchers on Presque Isle, north of Erie, spot one or maybe two snowy owls. John Lasco says last November, the first owl showed up. Then they spotted another.
Soon there were five, and then there were six, and then there was eight, and then there were up to 13 to 15 snowy owls all at one time on the park.
Lascos is an environmental educator at the Tom Ridge Environmental Center on Presque Isle. Snowy owls are adapted to live at the top of the world in the dark, cold Arctic winter. He says the unusually high numbers on Presque Isle have encouraged other winter visitors to the area, photographers, researchers.
The birders especially went crazy over this.
And it's not just on Presque Isle.
Oh my God, that thing is beautiful. Jeez.
Ron Cole was among the birders who stopped along a roadside south of Jamestown, New York, to look at this snoozing snowy, its fluffy white feathers dotted with black and its sharp yellow eyes.
Oh, those eyes.
Yeah.
Those eyes are beautiful.
Snowies are among the largest owls, weighing in at around 5 pounds, with a 4-foot-long wingspan. They're known by many because of Harry Potter's pet raptor, Hedwig. Scott Weidensall of Millersburg in eastern Pennsylvania has been studying them for many years and is excited by the numbers and attention they're getting this year.
It's madness, I tell you.
Weidensall is a naturalist who's led groundbreaking owl research at the Ned Smith Center for Nature and Art.
We're in the middle of what's known as an eruption, and that's spelled I-R-R rather than E-R.
He says snowy owl eruptions occur every 3 to 5 years, but researchers didn't expect anything of this magnitude, the large numbers of owls so widespread across North America. Weidensall and a few colleagues started something called Project Snowstorm last year to start tracking snowies. He says he's never been involved in a project that got pulled together so quickly.
The first week of December, we all kind of looked around at each other and said, oh my God, there's snowy owls everywhere. This is too good an opportunity to pass up. And so we very quickly, I mean, in a matter of about a week or so, mobilized collaborators across the eruption zone from New England out into Minnesota.
One of the big questions for researchers has been why so many of these big fluffy raptors have flown south from the Arctic this year. Henry Tepper is president of Mass Audubon. They've long been involved in owl research, in part because so many snowy owls spend time at the Boston airport. They've seen 85 snowy owls so far this winter.
Some original thinking, which was just kind of logical, was that these birds were showing up in the wintertime because they were hungry, because their food supply in the tundra and the Arctic and the boreal areas was somehow limited. That actually turns out not to be true.
Researchers say most of the owls they've captured are well-fed and healthy. Tepper and others attribute this to a population boom in hamster-like rodents known as lemmings in the Arctic during the owls' breeding season last year.
And that resulted in a lot of food supply for snowy owls and therefore very high nesting productivity. So there were a lot of young birds hatched last season. And then what happens is when winter comes, you have a lot of young birds and they're chased off their feeding grounds by adult birds. And they have to range much more widely in search of food in the wintertime.
That's the best explanation researchers have so far about why the owls have flown thousands of miles south, showing up in backyards, along roadsides, and at airports. But it begs the question, why were there so many lemmings? Naturalist Paul Weidensell says it's just part of their natural population cycle.
They boom and bust roughly every 4 years, and that's typical of a lot of small rodents up in northern areas. They're not really quite sure what causes the cycle.
But some researchers think there's more going on. Lemmings usually burrow in Arctic grasses hidden by snow. By one theory, warming temperatures and less snow have given them fewer places to hide and made them easier prey for snowy owls. But Weidensall wouldn't connect the owl eruption with warming Arctic temperatures.
No, definitely not. I really don't see any link between this and climate change.
But some research out of Greenland shows the lemming population is collapsing in parts of the Arctic, and that could be affecting snowy owls. Other work has described how melting sea ice is making it more difficult for the owls to find ducks, a major source of food in the winter. Henry Tepper at Audubon understands why some scientists are leery of pegging the snowy owl eruption to climate change.
We have to be careful about speculation. We have to be careful about thinking that we know or saying that we know more about these birds than we really do. But we also know what is going on out there, and we also know that the movement of different species is changing and being disrupted.
One thing the researchers agree on is there's a lot to learn about these mysterious raptors, and this year's Southern Travels are providing the best chance yet to study them. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at alleghenyfront.org. Visitors to the Highlands Museum and Discovery Center in Ashland, Kentucky may soon be able to watch satellites from Morehead State University's Space Science Center orbit the Earth. Highlands Director Carol Allen says the museum has been working with university officials to develop an area in the center where people can view the satellites as they circle the globe.
Morehead now has three satellites in orbit, and it will be an operation where we'll be able to follow, track the satellite's revolution around the world in real time. And it's a 90-minute revolution. So the students or whoever will be able to watch that take place.
Allen says the viewing area will be part of a larger display on space exploration.
We're so excited to be able to agree on a new space exhibit at the museum. We are going to put it in the Discovery Center where the exhibits are down there, and we're making it so it will be classroom friendly so that we can later on even have workshops for some of the school students that do come through our museum.
Allen says the viewing area will be part of a larger display on space exploration. Two new geocache trails geared toward tourists opened up this weekend in West Virginia. The Cabell County Huntington Geo Trail will take visitors on a treasure hunt through Cabell County looking for 15 caches. The Cabell Huntington Convention and Visitors Bureau website says the trail will include various types of geocaches, including traditionals, unknowns, and multis. This is the first time Cabell County has offered a geocache trail. Meanwhile, the Martinsburg-Berkeley County Convention and Visitors Bureau kicks off its second annual geocache trail. Geocaching, for the uninitiated, is a treasure hunt. Participants place a box, usually something waterproof and made of plastic, somewhere, then put the GPS coordinates on a website. Other people can then hunt for the box using the coordinates. The boxes have a log that people sign when they find it and often contain trinkets that geocachers can trade for something they bring. Berkeley County designed a trail last year called the Villages of Berkeley County, which took geocachers to various communities. Convention and Visitors Bureau Executive Director Laura Gassler says this year's event is called Gadgets of Berkeley County.
It's not so much the difficulty in finding it, it's the difficulty in opening it. So it's going to be a very challenging trail, very different from the last one.
To design the gadget caches, the Visitors Bureau enlisted the help of the March 2013 Geocacher of the Month, West Virginia Tim, a.k.a. Tim Eggleston of Berkeley County. Eggleston is a retired Verizon executive who's been geocaching for about 5 years now. He designed a Boy Scout-themed cache for last year's Jamboree, as well as those for the Villages of Berkeley County Trail. Eggleston also created all 13 gadget caches along this year's trail.
For example, I have a gadget cache right now at a local fire department, and it's painted like a fire department. It's bright red, and you open a drawer and it gives you a balloon. Well, you have to take that balloon and open the geocache because there's horns and holes and buttons, and so you have this balloon in your hand, and now you got to convince yourself. You say, okay, I've got a balloon. Now, what can I do to open this cache? And you can see a door, but you have to use the balloon correctly. And when you do the right thing with the balloon, the cache opens up. And it just puts a smile on people's face.
And how do you think of these things?
You know, I get asked that question all the time. I don't know. I wake up in the middle of the night and I just have these crazy ideas. I'll maybe go to wash my hands at one of those things in the bathroom, you know, and a motion detector picks up your hands. And I go, hey, why can't I use a motion detector to turn on a light that will give people the codes to figure out how to open this geocache? So there's one of our caches actually is going to use a motion detector.
This year's offerings include a night cache where visitors will go to a piece of public land and follow reflective trail markers to find the cache. Another uses the sense of smell.
You're going to pull up to it and you're going to open a drawer, and there's going to be numbers associated with different smells, and you're going to have to smell. And that sounds really easy until you smell clove and you get clove on the end of your nose, and then you open the next container over and it's wintergreen, and you mix the smells, and then from then on your sense of smell is just screwed up the rest of the day. And so you associate smells with numbers.
Geocachers who take up the challenge in Berkeley County must find and open 12 of the 13 caches on the trail. The first 300 to do so will receive a commemorative coin. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Water has been big news in West Virginia since a chemical leak into the Elk River near Charleston January 9th contaminated the drinking water for 300,000 people in 9 counties. Many still remain leery of drinking the water, and Governor Earl Ray Tomlin has appealed the decision by the Federal Emergency Management Agency to deny West Virginia's request for federal assistance. While the chemical spill created a temporary problem for customers of West Virginia American Water, some people living in other parts of the state deal continuously with unusable water. West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly has been following the situation in Wyoming County and has this report.
It's a basic human need. There's food, clothing, shelter, and water. How long could you go without clean water in your home? Governor Tomlin issued a state of emergency in 9 West Virginia counties for almost 7 weeks. The declaration dispatched the National Guard to assist and deliver clean water for the affected residents. But for the town of North Fork, a boil water advisory since July of 2013, didn't get any attention and has not merited a state of emergency.
We usually have to do bottled water because we don't drink it at all. Even on good days, we don't ever drink the water here.
Nicole Bright lives in North Fork with her husband and 2 children. Including the active advisory, the town of about 180 customers has been on 7 boil water advisories since 2009, some lasting for months. It's been an ongoing issue for years.
That's not how it's supposed to be. This is like third world country or something.
Bright welcomes me into her home and explains that the white plastic buckets stacked at the door are for holding water. The family has to be prepared for the next time they go without water.
Madis, she's small, so she bathed a lot in the sea. But here's some more water jugs. But as far as us, we had to go to like my grandma's, or, and here it is. And also,
Bright taps on another stack of plastic containers piled in the hallway just outside the bathroom. This stack is to flush the toilets. You see, here, the biggest challenge is having water at all.
The water, it goes off pretty often and stays off for about, last time was 27 days. And it's real hard to do with the kids going to school and cleaning and washing clothes and cooking and dishes. It's just really hard.
Bright says this time she lost water on January 13th, and it remained off for more than 5 weeks.
It's always clear like it is today, but usually before it goes off or anything, it'll be real dirty looking, and then it'll be orange.
For Bright and other residents in North Fork, losing water is so common that her family now has a routine when she does laundry, brushes her teeth, and other everyday tasks. To do the dishes, she first goes to the front porch. And then?
Get the water, then you come in, you take 5 gallon buckets and pour it into a little bitty pot, and then we heat it up, which usually takes about, 45 minutes or something to do to fill them up and get enough water in there to wash and rinse.
Added expenses include bottled water, paper plates, and travel. Still, she tries not to complain.
3 or 4 days, yes. When it's out for a while, we do call, especially when you're able to get off the hill and not see anyone working on it. Now, my neighbor, she'll call them every 5 minutes. That's why I try not to give them such a hard time, because Lord knows I know she does. So I try to be nice, and then I'll call the neighbors.
The water system operated by the town of North Fork is outdated, and the filter needs to be replaced. So employees have to flush the system about every other day, causing the pressure to drop, especially for customers like Bright, who live at higher elevations.
It seems like sometimes when you live in a place like this, you're not heard, as well as you would be if you were somewhere else in a different town or something like that. Here it's like, okay, you're in North Fork, so what, you're in McDowell County. What do you expect? That kind of attitude.
The latest boil water advisory for about 180 customers on the town's water system was issued after the filter basically stopped working. It's located inside a deteriorating building in North Fork along the Elkhorn Creek River. On a cold winter day, city workers show me around.
This is the building such as it is, and it's antique. You can see that.
The rust runs deep inside the two-story cinder block building. Upstairs is access to 2 water filters. The workers say that the water comes from a deep well under the building. The well is fed to a tank on a hill and then flows back to the pump house to be filtered, put in a clear well, and finally pumped to customers. Larry Porterfield works for the city and helps maintain the water system.
Actually, it's not bad because I work here and I know the water ain't really that bad, and I'd still drink it. I mean, I don't advise people to drink it, but I drink it. We drink. Actually, we all drink it. I mean, they just put it on there because we need to replace the filtering. That's all. I don't think nothing wrong with the water.
The filtration system is dated and needs to be replaced. To cope, Porterfield says they flush the system about every other day, which causes pressure to drop.
Normally, we usually do it maybe every 2 days, maybe every 3 days. That's what they recommend. But now we have to do it every other day because our filtration material has got to its limit where it's not working anymore. So we need to replace that, and that will filter the water better.
Downstairs, Porterfield shows me the pressure reading. On this day, it was high.
Yeah. Everybody should be having pretty good pressure right now. But like when the pressure goes down, it goes down to about 60, sometimes maybe 40. And that's when people on our higher elevations will not be receiving water.
Flushing combined with a bitter cold winter, several private busted pipes, and almost constantly running water to keep pipes from freezing creates very low pressure at times. North Fork worker Joe Gadberry says finding and fixing underground leaks is yet another challenge.
We basically create miracles with what we got. What we got, we maintain, but we make sure they have water. I mean, it'd be nice to have a backhoe, but most of the time we're digging by hand.
To the right of the metal stairs, a large pipe runs parallel to the ground. The pipe eventually curves through the floor. At the bend sits a meter covered in what appears to be a mixture of moisture, rust, and corrosion. I ask Porterfield about it.
Oh, it's just... This is our master meter, but it's in op right now. It's not work right now. They're in the process of getting this one. Actually, I'll let you see it. It tells how much gallons of water we're pumping out. But right now, it's inoperative. So
at City Hall, I find City Councilman Curtis Spencer, who also serves as chairman of the water board.
It's an old system, and we just trying to make it last till the PSD come down to it, but there's no definite date when they're going to be here.
North Fork will eventually be a part of the Elkhorn Water Project. The project is broken down into four phases with plans to pick up old coal camp towns along Route 52, starting just past the Mercer-McDowell lines where a new water plant will be located. The initial water line will be installed from there through Mayberry and eventually ending up in North Fork Hollow. Bids for Phase 1 go out this month, and construction is expected to be complete after 1 year. Phase 2, which is still at least 2 years away, is expected to bring a dependable clean water supply to North Fork. The McDowell County Public Service District has been working to coordinate the projects as quickly as possible. Executive Director Mavis Brewster says it just takes time.
You have a lot of times the residents, they don't understand the process. They just have a need for the water, and they don't understand all the hoops that you have to jump through. So it is at times frustrating and it's a little discouraging. But overall, I've been at the PSD for like 12 years, you know, and I've seen so many projects from the beginning to the finished. And it's so rewarding once you see that project finished and those residents actually having water, good, safe, quality water that they've never had before.
Brewster says the biggest challenge is securing funding. She hopes small cities block grants will pay for Phase 2. The Water Board was created late December 2013 to make improvements to the system and collect on delinquent accounts. Board Chairman Curtis Spencer says about 40% of the customers have stopped paying their bills. Phase 2 is dependent upon an election in neighboring Keystone. The town has to tie into the PSD in order to move the project along. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in North Fork.
Water is also of interest to 10 students from the University of San Francisco who were in West Virginia this past week, spending their spring break getting a first-hand look at the coal and gas industries. Among the activities on the immersion trip taking place through Wheeling Jesuit University's Appalachian Institute was helping a nonprofit organization in Shepherdstown, SkyTruth, locate ponds at natural gas hydraulic fracturing sites in Pennsylvania.
So we could essentially go back home, type in this website,
yes.
And then just start clicking away.
Yes.
Cool. Here in Shepherdstown, the students became frack finders. Working with David Manthus from the nonprofit organization SkyTruth, they used computer software and satellite imagery to document observations about ponds at hydraulic fracturing sites in Pennsylvania.
We're using the same aerial imagery that you can find in Google Maps, that you can see in Google Earth, as well as data from the state of Pennsylvania saying where drilling locations are.
The students sit in a conference room at the Presbyterian Church in downtown Shepherdstown with their laptops and tablets. They're studying aerial images of hydraulic fracturing sites, mostly square or rectangular patches of bare brown earth that stand out from the green vegetation surrounding them.
We show you a place on the map, we show you the aerial images of it, and say, what do you see here? So these students here are coming here to help us out and look through all of this imagery for the state of Pennsylvania and locate these wastewater ponds.
I know there's been some talk in the legislature about moving some stuff forward to ban fracking like they did in New York State, right? Mm-hmm.
Riley Chadwell says the SkyTruth technology allows frack finders to zoom in on the images. They answer questions about what they see, including whether there's a pond or not.
The first couple are kind of hard. I have to admit it's kind of confusing at first, but after a while you get the hang of it and you can start to kind of decipher, you know, okay, that looks like a frack pond or that doesn't look like one. So it's really cool technology.
How do you tell?
You're able to tell by whether the trees are cleared around the pond, and also if there's you can kind of tell if there's been like a dig site with a cement block, or there's a lot of buildings around the pond. Also, the shape of the pond is also another way we're looking at determining whether it's a frack pond. typically they're very industrialized shapes, like a rectangle or a square. Not so natural.
I think it's a good title to have, being a frack finder.
Julia Morielli likes the fact that anyone can become a frack finder and contribute to the project.
It's a universal thing. I love the fact that you can go anywhere and use this website and use this technology that we have and share it and educate others using the characteristics that we've been given to identify these fracking sites and facilitate the process of identifying which sites are fracking sites, which sites are active, which sites are impactful, and increasing the data and actually doing your part.
The University of San Francisco students say Californians, like people in the Marcellus Shale region of West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New York, are debating the wisdom of hydraulic fracturing to extract oil and gas from the earth. Last year, Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill regulating the industry, and opponents would like to see the practice banned. Pepe Gill points out environmental issues affect everyone one way or another, no matter where you live.
We're all kind of connected in one way or another, like as an ecosystem. You know, so in the sense that, you know, if one species suffers, we all kind of experience some effect as well, because fracking, hydraulic fracturing, and other non-conventional resource extraction occurs all over the world, not just, you know, here.
What do you take back to California?
In addition to a username and a password for Frack Finder, I take back quite a bit of increased knowledge. I mean, this us being here today with Sky Truth is only one part of our journey, or one part of our immersion here in Appalachia. And I think that this all kind of contributes, like I said, to the increased awareness, increased solidarity for an issue that maybe some of us didn't really know too much about before. And we'll be able to take that back with us, as it's been said, and hopefully apply some of this newfound call to action or to apply some of this back to our own communities for our own issues that we are concerned about.
SkyTruth's David Manthus says the data collected by these students and other frack finders will be used by Johns Hopkins University.
The purpose of that is to inform a public health study on if the evaporation from those ponds contributes to problems, respiratory distress, and neonatal problems. So they're going to, once we have a map of where the ponds are, you can actually start to do an analysis with public health data. Is there a correlation? Is there problems with living near one of these sites?
The students also traveled to the Morgantown and Washington, Pennsylvania area to visit the Center for Coalfield Justice and spend time with the Friends of Decker's Creek collecting water samples. They also visited with the West Virginia Coal Association and saw a mountaintop removal mining site. Two noted scientists who are originally from West Virginia, Ellen and Lonnie Thompson, returned to the state this past week to present a lecture warning about the carbon footprint we're all making. Ellen is from Kanawha County, Lonnie from Braxton County. They met at Marshall University, married in 1971, and are noted scientists who travel the world studying climate change. Last May, they were in West Central Tibet, drilling into ancient glaciers to determine the age of the ice there. They've been around the world several times over to drill into ice and study it. They spoke with West Virginia Public Radio's Beth Voorhees.
I mean, I don't want to take away from fossil fuels. We would not have the economy of the world if we didn't have fossil fuels. But the fact is, the result of using those fossil fuels are now changing the climate of the planet, and we have to adjust. And I believe that if you look at employment in this country, there are now about 50,000 coal miners in the U.S. There are over 100,000 people working in the solar industry. It's changing, and it's important that the young people in West Virginia prepare for tomorrow's world. And, you know, this is what education and development and growth is about. We'll be using coal for a long time because we've built this society on it. But it's not the future. The future is in these alternative resources.
Okay. Well, we're both born in West Virginia. So we understand what coal means to the state. I mean, my grandfather was a coal miner up in Kingston, West Virginia. And, you know, we know that, as Lonnie said, the economy that we have, the luxuries that we have, were all built with cheap energy. And essentially that's coal. cheap, abundant energy, and that's coal. And all you have to do is envision what your life is like when you have an ice storm and you lose your electricity. We have a reality check how dependent we are on having those electrons flowing across the grid. And in the future, we're going to have to make bigger investments in other sources of energy, but we still have coal and natural gas will be carrying us over the next few decades as we ramp up with other energies. So this isn't, this isn't where we're going to flip a switch, turn off coal, and ultimately turn off gas and just live on renewable energies. The infrastructure's not there.
Do you have solar energy at your own home?
No, we do not. We are discussing that. Certainly, we know people in Columbus, Ohio, who are using solar very positively. One nice way is we've been looking at purchase. We drive a Prius right now, but we've been looking at the all-electric car. And then what some people do is put the solar panels on their garages and charge their car, that way. I would say, though, that our team in 1983 used the first solar-powered ice core drill in the Andes of Peru to collect ice cores, and that was a much better, cleaner, and easier way to drill at 18,600 feet in the Andes than dragging big generators and 55-gallon drums of fuel up. We're on our third set of solar panels for our drills.
I would just add that both of us went to Marshall University to do our undergraduate. I got my undergraduate in geology, and I actually went to Ohio State to study coal geology. So, I understand the importance of coal in this part of the world, but I also realize that the future is different, and we need to embrace it. Our young people need to embrace it. And our educational system needs to train those young people for what will be better jobs of the future.
Lonnie and Ellen Thompson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Beth.
Thank you.
Lonnie and Ellen Thompson, professors at the Byrd Polar Research Center at Ohio State University, speaking with Beth Voorhees. If you could not attend their lecture in Charleston, you can go online and see videos on their university website. You can go to wvpublic.org to find out how to do that. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Eight communities across West Virginia are getting some financial help in dealing with dilapidated buildings thanks to grants from the Northern West Virginia Brownfields Assistance Center at West Virginia University. As Rebecca Glover reports, one of the $10,000 technical assistance grants goes to a small village in Jefferson County.
The village of Middleway in Jefferson County appears to be a moment frozen in time. The historic district is home to buildings that date back to the late 18th and early 19th centuries, and the town was a battleground throughout the Civil War. Nowadays, the streets are quiet, the cars are few, and the numerous buildings that line the streets are dark and uninviting. Moss and vines creep up the old war hospital on Queen Street, and residential properties are boarded up and left alone. These abandoned buildings have become places to drop off refuse and tires, and shelter for squatters and drug abusers. The president of the Middleway Conservancy Association, Peter Fricka, grew up on a farm in England, so he appreciates the small-town feel of Middleway and wants to help restore the community to its better days.
We had a much smaller village than we had here, but it certainly gave me the feel of this sort of community and density. And of course, in England, farms are in families for generations, and this is true here too. And so when I moved here, coming from an English farm and having been in all sorts of other things, it was, in a way, coming home.
The Conservancy Association is beginning the process of restoring Middleway thanks to a $10,000 Brownfields Abandoned Dilapidated Buildings, or BAD, Technical Assistance Grant. In its first year, the BAD Buildings Program helps communities in West Virginia identify and prioritize properties based on community need. Project Manager of Northern West Virginia Brownfields Assistance Center, Luke Elser, traveled to communities throughout the state and spoke with councils and mayors to address the issue of abandoned and dilapidated buildings in their areas. An independent committee of experts across the field reviewed applications and chose which communities would receive the grant. Elser says the program provides citizens with tools to solve their independent issues at a local level.
There's people in these communities that want to do something, but just need to be pointed in the right direction and be shown sort of what steps to start taking. And then our experience has been that these projects really take off in fantastic directions we never would have imagined.
The Middleway Historic District was the only unincorporated community and one of eight statewide to receive the grant. The others are Fairmont, Point Pleasant, Canova, Roncevert, Shinston, Wheeling, and Weston. Elser describes the restoration of abandoned buildings in West Virginia as a huge need. He says the unused buildings lower property values, tax base, and reduces community morale.
It makes the community less desirable to live in. So if you live next to a couple of properties that are abandoned and have windows knocked out and grass overgrown, you're just less likely to want to stay there. So people move away from these properties and it sort of becomes a cancer within a community. And if we're trying to promote West Virginia's communities as economically viable and positive places to be and live, we need to sort of tackle these abandoned building issues.
In order to obtain the grant, Peter Fricka talked to people who would have an interest or would benefit directly from Middleway's restoration, including the county commission and various local churches. The process of development will begin when WVU staff comes to Middleway to train an assessment team to evaluate properties and determine their status. The grant will provide a series of options for the community to achieve its goals, ultimately putting a better economic and social spin on the village, including advice for individual property owners. The community will receive an interim report in July and will begin setting priorities after that. In addition to bringing commerce back into the village, Fricka says other community suggestions have been considered.
The suggestions we have are that a couple of the lots that are currently vacant be cleared and used for other purposes with in-character buildings so that they're not sore thumbs. A lot of people have talked about pedestrian safety.
With the Middleway Conservancy Association acting as a facilitator, the participation in the grant is voluntary and driven at the property owner and community level. To view photos of the Middleway Village, visit wvpublic.org. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Glover in Shepherdstown.
In the old days, every rural community boasted a general store. Traveling 219's Roxy Todd found one of these old stores, which now has a new purpose, holds fond memories for some.
Not long ago, it was common for nearly every small community to have its own general store, or two, or three. At the center of the store, there would be an old potbelly stove, glowing with heat that drew people together. Some of the most vivid memories are of the men who sat clustered around the stove, telling stories and lies. Others remember candy jars, fresh sliced bacon, buckets full of marbles. But ask anyone to show you whatever happened to these old general stores, and often they point out the empty buildings or lots where their favorite places are no longer standing. At least one of these old store buildings has not disappeared. Moore's Store in Hillsboro, West Virginia, now the Pretty Penny Cafe, will turn 100 years old this summer. In the 1980s, the store finally closed, but the space was converted into a restaurant. Since then, it has been the Rosewood Cafe, the Four Winds Restaurant, and in 2009, Blair Campbell transformed it into the Pretty Penny Cafe. The tin ceiling, the wood floors, the old shelves along the walls. Blair says they're all original, from when the store first opened in 1914. There are even the classic old wooden ladders with rollers at the bottom, which William Moore used to climb to reach the goods stored on the top shelf, 12 feet from the ground.
Oh, he had everything in it. Had men's clothing and women's, and he even had the automobile parts.
This is William's widow, Opal Moore,
and he had got a great big round thing of cheese, and he had a cheese cutter and just cut off slices. Then he had a slicer that he'd get a whole bacon and slice it up for people. It was real good bacon, better than what you get now. Any way you wanted, he could slice them.
She admits that the store was not her favorite place to work. She much preferred to be out working in her garden. But to thousands of children who grew up in Hillsboro, Moore's store was their favorite place. They remember it because it was the place they could buy candy and soda. And William Moore was the beloved keeper of all this treasure.
The kids used to come from up to school and buy their lunch. They'd buy cookies and cokes and stay in there then until time to go back to school. They used to just get chips and pop and candy bars and cookies.
But Moore's store wasn't just a place for children to buy snacks. The store also sold most of the town's groceries and hardware. But when larger grocery stores came to nearby areas in the 1980s, the historic Moore's store quickly lost most of its business.
It was pretty busy back a long time ago, but then after they got all the Kroger stores and Walmart and everything down in Lewisburg, there wasn't much business.
Today, people in Hillsboro drive 45 minutes south to Kroger or Walmart to do most of their shopping. But the Pretty Penny Cafe still buys local, using local produce, eggs, and meat from farms in Pocahontas County for the meals they serve. A bakery in nearby Frankfort supplies bread for the sandwiches. And like the old store, the Pretty Penny Cafe has kind of become the community gathering place to many people in Hillsboro. On any given Friday evening, local old-time and bluegrass musicians play here, and Blair usually has a few touring bands play at the Pretty Penny each month. The candy jars might have disappeared, but the walls of this building still resonate with the memories of what was once Moore's General Store.
This story was produced by Roxy Todd of the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio with support for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and AmeriCorps Vista. To learn more, visit traveling219.com or Facebook. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. A new crawdad species has been discovered in West Virginia, Camberis hatfieldi, from the Tug Fork River Basin. It's actually one of three new crayfish species that have recently been discovered and named. West Virginia Public Radio's Glennis Board spoke with the researcher behind the discoveries and brings us this lesson on crayfish.
Under the pond.
Oh my, what is that?
This is called the bottle brush crayfish. It's native to the Green River in Kentucky, and it's one of the top two largest species of crayfish in West Virginia.
Okay.
Not in West Virginia, in Kentucky, that's wrong.
Okay.
So, he's a big guy.
Zachary Loafman is a professor of biology at West Liberty University and one of about 9 crayfish biologists in the country. He just pulled what looks to me like a small green lobster out of an aquarium. It's big. Its claws outstretched reach at least a foot wide. And this is no fish story. This is a crawdad story.
If you would have told me when I was here at West Liberty as a student that I'd be naming new species in West Virginia, I would have looked at you like you were a crazy person. I never in a million years saw this avenue actually come into light.
Get him talking about crawdads, and you'll see what raw, genuine enthusiasm looks like.
Any second of any day, I will look for crayfish. Period.
Yeah, spend enough time with Loafman, and you might start to love crawdads, too.
My field crews, They laugh because we normally get up in the morning, we're out looking for the crayfish, we stop, eat lunch, maybe, keep looking for the crayfish, eat dinner, and then most of the time we don't want to sit and just stare at each other, so we go back out with our headlamps on and keep looking for crayfish. So it's pretty much in the summertime, when we're out doing the field work, it's perpetual.
That diligence is certainly yielding returns. His latest crawdad species has been dubbed Camberis hatfieldi, after the famous feuding family, because it's found in Mate Creek, the same creek on which the Hatfields' homestead was built. Loafman has been studying crayfish for about a decade. He says he chose crayfish because, well, no one else really has. A lot about crayfish is shrouded in mystery, from simple things like, how long do they live? To more complicated queries, like, how do they raise their young? Loafman says all that mystery makes the job very exciting. Nothing but discoveries.
We definitely found out that they aren't little robots. They all kind of do their own thing. We had some animals that spent an entire month and a half underneath one rock. We actually thought maybe they're dead under there. And at the end of the study, we flipped the rock and there he is, you know, waving his claws at us. We had other animals that we put the transmitters on. And every single night, they moved half a football field up and down the stream. We had one animal that would go from the head of a riffle down to the bottom of a riffle, you know, over the course of a night, and then go back to the head of the riffle the next night, and then go back to the bottom of the riffle. We had absolutely no biological explanation for that, but, you know, he did it. So they're quirky, and that's one of the things that I absolutely love the most about them.
Today you can find more than 60 crawdads living in a variety of aquariums in Loafman's West Liberty Lab. And so many more, pickled and cataloged. It's crazy. And for all we don't know about them, we do know that they are the third most endangered animal group in the country.
There's a species in the coal fields right now called the big sandy crayfish. And in the late 80s, it was known from 17 streams. And we've spent a tremendous amount of time in the coal fields looking for this animal. And it is now only known from 3 streams. Oh, wow. It's definitely on its way out.
Loafman is super passionate about natural history and conservation.
We now know the number one threat to crayfish across West Virginia, and that's sedimentation.
Loafman says not finding crayfish in a stream is a pretty good indicator that something, or more likely someone, has disturbed the ground in the watershed around the stream, causing sediment to clog all the little spaces between the rocks where crayfish like to chill.
If you do anything to the floodplain or the habitat, the hillside, up from a stream, it's going to basically result in a lot of sediment getting into the creek.
Loafman goes on to explain that while they are still working to discover all the roles that crayfish play in stream ecologies, one key role is creating avenues by which many other stream dwellers move about.
So when the crayfish go away, you see this net cascade loss of diversity because all the animals that are kind of dependent on them slowly but surely phase out too.
In addition to habitat disruption and stream sedimentation, Loafman says invasive species often introduced by fishermen are another big threat to crayfish.
It's been proven in other states, is one person repeatedly bringing crayfish from one stream to another stream.
Loafman says when folks use crayfish as bait, it's really, really important to the ecology of the stream for them not to drop their living leftover crawdads into the stream if the crayfish came from somewhere else. Apparently, it's a pretty competitive world in crawdad land, and we can really mess up the balance of power by flinging crayfish about. Okay, little known fact, West Virginia has 30 species of crayfish that we know of so far. Well, in Europe, they have like 8 or 9. And someone from the U.S. up and popped one of our species, all covered in this fungus, into one or some of their streams. That's really bad news, because that fungus is deadly to native European crayfish.
As these native European crayfish are wiped out, our guys take over, and North American crayfish behave a little differently than European crayfish. They dig a lot more. So you end up with stream bank failure. You end up with a loss of diversity. It's having economical impacts.
Loafman says there are a bunch of crayfish biologists in Europe now because the invasion is so problematic and ultimately wreaking economic and environmental havoc. But his efforts remain in Appalachia, where he says he has plenty to keep him busy.
If you go to places like the Mon National Forest and collect crayfish, I'm a very happy guy and everything's wonderful. If I drop down onto the plateau near any of our big cities, you know, Wheeling, Parkersburg, Clarksburg, Huntington, Charleston, then we start to get a little bit sad because the crayfish numbers are down and the sedimentation issues everywhere.
So if we leave you with anything to remember from this report, it's this.
If you're fishing in Wheeling Creek, get your bait from Wheeling Creek. Don't get your bait from Wheeling Creek and then drive over to the Potomac River and use that bait. And that is actually the absolute worst thing you can possibly do, because that's how we end up getting invasive crayfish.
Please tell all your fishing friends. Seriously. Thanks. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.